Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the dramatic discovery of a missing Boston woman in a Charlestown apartment. Technology is credited as the key.
It's obvious from the video surveillance that she did not go along willingly.
Also today, the debate over supervised drug injection facilities and how it's playing out in cities besides Boston.
Our entire recovery understanding is you need to get away from drugs, just say no, hit rock bottom. What we know for a fact is that that didn't work for 70,000 people that died from an overdose.
Plus,
you are fake news.
A new study about the spread of fake news in the 2016 election. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The alleged kidnapping of a Boston woman last weekend has shed some light on just how ubiquitous surveillance is throughout the city. 23-year-old Olivia Ambrose disappeared after leaving a bar in Boston early Sunday. When her sister wasn't able to reach her, she used a smartphone feature that told her the last location of Ambrose's phone. Law enforcement then used that and surveillance footage and found the Charlestown apartment where Ambrose was allegedly being held against her will. The man who lived in that apartment is now charged with kidnapping. Boston Police Commissioner William Gross talks about how cameras were used to find Ambrose.
Through various camera systems in and around Congress Street, we were able to ascertain that the victim was seen walking on Congress Street, where she was later engaged by two males.
And while this story has a somewhat happy ending, it does highlight potential privacy concerns. And joining us to talk about this is Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray. Hello there.
Hello.
Also with us, Cade Crockford, director of the Technology and Liberty Program for the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Hi, Cade.
Hi, Deb.
So, listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you share your location on your cell phone? How do you feel about surveillance cameras? And does it feel like someone's always watching? Is it worth it for safety? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Hiawatha, I want to start with you. You know, it's not new, right, that people share their locations on their phones and you can see where people are and that we have cameras. What do you think this case highlights about that in your mind?
Well, you know, we've gone through a lot recently of people talking about.
Hiawatha, are you with us? We can't hear you at all.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There we go. Okay.
Okay. We've gone through a lot recently with this almost paranoid sense that we are being watched too closely, and it's dangerous and it's scary. And I share a lot of those concerns. But what happened here is a reminder of the fact that this technology was actually originally invented to save lives. People have forgotten that. We think that the location stuff inside our phones, like GPS, was invented so that we could avoid traffic jams. No, it wasn't. It was actually devised almost, the idea of doing it was imposed on the industry by the FCC in 1996, saying you've got to build a way to track phones so that when people dial 911, we can come save them. That's what it was for in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So just for folks who don't completely know, this may be the history behind it, but what about consent to using it, and can you turn it off? Maybe you don't want people to know where you are.
Well, let's figure this out. First of all, when it comes to 911, no, you can't figure it out. Even more, no, you can't switch it off, rather.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Even more fundamentally, by the very nature of how a cell phone works, the cell phone company always has a fair idea of where you are, not down to the square foot, but they have to track you because that's how cell phones work as you move from one place to another. So you can't use a cell phone without, to some extent, being physically tracked.
Mm-hmm. But what about this friend locator that we were talking about in this specific case with Olivia Ambrose? I mean, her sister had a friend locator on her phone. Talk to us about this app and about, you know, how selective we might be in terms of controlling it.
Well, this is, it's entirely up to you whether to use it or not. It's a standard feature on the iPhone. You can get something similar for Android phones. And on the iPhone, it's called Find My Friends. You go through your address book. Is there somebody in it where you want them to be able to find you whenever they wanted to know where you were? You can connect to them through Find My Friends and ask, do you want to know where I am? Do you want me to know where you are? Mm-hmm. And if you guys agree to share your location, now, anytime you want to, they can know where they can know where you are, and you can know where they are.
Kate Crockford,
and it's voluntary. But, okay. You pick and choose who can do this.
Kate Crockford, you weigh in here. What do you think of what this case suggests about cameras, about surveillance, and about cell phones?
So that last point is really crucial. Privacy is actually not about secrecy. People often get confused and think privacy and secrecy are the same thing, but they're not. Privacy is about control. It's about our ability to control information about ourselves and therefore to control our lives. So we should be able to use modern technology and control how information about us is collected, how it's accessed, who uses it, in what circumstances. And right now, frankly, we can't. We don't have that control. In this case, the young woman chose, as Hiawatha said, to enable a feature on her iPhone that allowed her sister and potentially other people to track her physical location through her phone. That's a choice that she made. We do not choose to allow cell phone companies to sell en masse our cell phone location information, which they do. We do not choose to allow app developers that, you know, make weather apps and run track apps and many other kinds of applications for Androids and iPhones to harvest up to 14,000 location data points a day from our phones and then turn around and sell that on the open advertising technology market. But that's exactly what's happening. So, you know, I think this issue raises some really pertinent questions about government surveillance, certainly. We at the ACLU have been very successful in the past few years in getting some protections for ordinary people to ensure that law enforcement cannot track our cell phone location history information unless they get a warrant. So a few years ago in Massachusetts, my colleagues here at the ACLU litigated a case called Augustine at the Supreme Judicial Court and secured a warrant requirement for law enforcement's access to this historical cell site location information that Hiawatha referenced, that cell phone companies create and keep in order to provide cell phone service to us. And then this past summer, the Supreme Court, in a critical ruling that builds upon that Augustine decision here in Massachusetts, said in the Carpenter case, which was also ACLU litigation, that in fact, nationwide, law enforcement needs to get a warrant if they want to access this stored cell site location information from our cell phone providers, which shows where we were at any given time. You know, there's an emergency exception to warrant requirements. So in the case where someone's life is immediately threatened, law enforcement can skip the requirement to get a warrant. That's pretty standard for all warrant processes. But those types of protections are really critical in the digital age. What we don't have right now as it pertains to location information is protections against private sector collection and sale and resale of this data. Just last week, a Motherboard reporter published a story about how he was able to pay a bail bondsman, a bounty hunter, $300. And that guy was able to track the journalist's cell phone within hours.
Hmm.
This is how unregulated this market is. And this is not just a privacy concern. This is a security concern for hundreds of millions of people across the country. this information is not just tracked on ordinary people. Police officers' cell phones are tracked in this way. The information about where judges and politicians and people within the national security complex are at any given moment is up for sale on the open market. So we really need lawmakers, especially at the federal level, but here in Massachusetts too, to look very closely at this completely unregulated surveillance capitalist marketplace and to effectively stop some of these really unfortunate and exploitative practices. Mm-hmm.
And what about, though, okay, that's cell phones, but what about cameras? Tell us about cameras, because, it wasn't just the cell phone location, because, then her phone was off, right? That was the last mm-hmm. location where folks could track Ms. Ambrose in this particular case. But after that, if they didn't have that surveillance footage, this might not have ended this way. So what do we know about cameras, and what about that information? Is that protected at all?
So that's an interesting question. One of the really critical things that the Supreme Court did in this Carpenter decision that they issued in July is say that we actually do have a right to privacy in public. For a long time, the court had held that when you're walking around in the public on the public streets, you don't have a right to privacy with respect to information about where you are, who you're with, or what you're doing, because you're out in public. Well, in this case, the government made the argument to the court that they ought to continue under that assumption and continue the precedent that says if someone's walking around in public with their cell phone, they don't have a right to privacy in that cell phone location information. The court said, wait a second, this is different. This is not like someone watching me walk out of my house and walk down the street. This is akin to the government collecting, or rather phone companies collecting, not on one person who may be a suspect in a criminal investigation, but on hundreds of millions of people who possess cell phones, detailed information about not just where we were last week, but where we were last year and every day in between now and then. And so this scale, the magnitude of what digital surveillance enables in terms of corporate and government surveillance, the court held, changes the balance of power so fundamentally between the governed and the people that the warrant requirement comes into play. And Justice Roberts actually said explicitly that people do have a right to privacy in public. And it's going to be really interesting to watch how the court interprets its own precedent in the Carpenter case when we start to see, cases about the use of networked surveillance camera systems like this one, or the use mm-hmm. of automated tracking technologies yeah. like biometrics, face recognition, things like that. So right now, we don't
have any
regulation of those systems,
Hiawatha?
But we certainly hope we will.
Okay. Hiawatha, go ahead.
I'm just going to say that right now we have a ways to go before you're going to have really reliable facial recognition just being with cameras aimed at thousands of people just walking down the street. You already have part of the controversy over this whole thing of Amazon working with police agencies to use facial recognition is the unreliability of it and the possibility that they're going to get things wrong. But we know for a certainty that there is a huge amount of effort and research going into doing exactly that. And if you throw enough computing power at it, it will eventually be possible for you to be walking down a street and kept under surveillance simply as you move from one video camera to another. Mm-hmm. That wasn't what happened here, as I understand it. Basically, they had some idea of the time that this person, these two people, would have come within view of these cameras. They looked through the footage and found their images there, basically eyeballing it. Mm-hmm. But eventually, they're going to be able to do that kind of thing with computer. They tried doing it with the Boston Marathon bomber. They didn't really seem to have a whole lot of success there. Mm-hmm. But little by little, we're moving in that direction. And we all know what China is doing. They are very aggressive about this. And they are saying in no uncertain terms, we're going to use facial recognition and video cameras to basically monitor our population. And we may not have the government do that here, but it's a distinct possibility that we might see a sort of a combination of public and private interests doing it. And it's something we really need to think about.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Can I
jump in really quickly that we are trying to prevent that dystopian world that China has unleashed on its people from unfolding here in Massachusetts. We are supporting legislation that has been introduced in this state legislative session that would implement a moratorium on the government's use of biometric tracking technologies like face recognition by law enforcement and government agencies in part because of what Hiawatha said, that the technology is just not ready yet. It's poor at identifying Black people. It's poor at identifying particularly dark-skinned women. But also because we really need to hit pause and have a very thorough, informed debate about what the benefits and what the drawbacks of that type of surveillance society are. And, you know, think about implementing some very strong regulations to protect privacy, free speech, personal autonomy, and democracy to ensure we don't end up like China.
Mm-hmm. I'm on it because we mentioned the Boston Marathon. I just want to go to one of our guests here, Chief Kelly Nee, who's chief of police for Boston University. Nee spent 33 years with the Boston Police, where she worked as a deputy superintendent of intelligence and analysis, and she helped craft plans for the marathon after the bombings in 2013. Chief Nee, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
I can. I just wonder, you know, you've been listening to this and we've been sort of talking about the benefits of using surveillance and cell phone trackers and other things to solve crimes like the one that was solved in Boston recently, but also some of the privacy drawbacks because of the increasing sophistication of technology. I wonder, what do you think in terms of the role of technology here in crime solving and how it's used currently?
Well, I know it's not often that law enforcement agrees with a lot of what the ACLU has to do, but I do agree that, you know, people's privacy needs to be protected, especially from corporations that are making money off of it. My opinion with regard to law enforcement, you know, law enforcement needs to have its authorities checked, and the court does a good job of that. I think most law enforcement entities use this technology appropriately. They use it with court authority. And it's important for us to have the capability in an emergency like the case that just happened, the Ambrose case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but some folks might say, you know, you might say that there are already ways to make sure that technology can be used in an emergency like the case that we're talking about. But there can also be abuses in the system, not just from the private sector, but also from the public sector as well. What can we do to protect people's privacy, Chief? When do you think, or how do you think a line could be drawn most effectively?
Well, I think it's up to the legislature to establish the rules, level the playing field. The courts have been, you know, consistently deciding, it seems, more into the interests of the individual and protecting their rights. And it's up to law enforcement to abide by those restrictions that are put in place.
Mm-hmm. Kate Crawford, your response.
I couldn't agree more. We think that until the legislature actually contemplates issues like biometric tracking, face recognition, we ought to press pause, because unfortunately what's happening now is what has happened for a long time in the United States with respect to digital surveillance and now artificial intelligence tools like face recognition, is that law enforcement adopts the technologies mostly in secret, oftentimes without any public debate or even any rules that they impose on themselves in terms of policy about what, you know, who can use the technology when or how the data is treated, unfortunately. And then only later, when abuses emerge, do we then have a conversation. And many decades later, in most cases, does the Supreme Court get a case where they're able to offer protections to the entire country? I mean, that's what happened in the Carpenter case, right? We'd been using cell phones for 20 years or more by the time the court held that cell phone location information ought to be protected with a warrant. So that's not an ideal way to do business in a democracy. And instead, we should really look to our legislative bodies, both here in Massachusetts and at the federal level, to deliberate over these issues, to, you know, pass comprehensive privacy reform that addresses the use of these technologies by law enforcement. And we think that ought to happen in the context of face recognition before the technology is in widespread use at police departments across the state.
Yeah, you know, it's important, though, to remember that much of the sensitive problems that this is raising is not a public sector thing. It's the private sector, these huge companies like Google and Facebook, that are scooping up this data and using it in ways where there is virtually no oversight because they are not government agencies. And a lot of what we need to be concerned about is how Google and Facebook and Apple and all these companies are collecting this data and doing heaven knows what with it. And
these are not
a comprehensive privacy.
Because every bit of information that corporations are collecting, of course, is accessible to the government, sometimes with a warrant,
Exactly right.
So I'm wondering, should there be no police use of this technology until we have strict legislative rules in place in terms of what is, off limits here? What would you say to that?
It depends on what you mean by this technology. I mean, for us, yes, we think that face recognition is uniquely dangerous. I mean, when you think about cell phone location tracking, right? Most people don't leave their phones at home, and so it's like an ankle monitor for most of us, right? Following us around, sometimes even into the bathroom. But you could theoretically leave your phone at home if you wanted to and go somewhere without being tracked by your cell phone company and therefore the government. You cannot leave your face at home. You cannot leave your face at home.
As much as you might like to.
And so as a result of that, and because of the way that this technology fundamentally actually lives inside police departments, in the case of cell phone tracking, at least law enforcement in most cases has to send a demand letter to a cell phone company. So there's an added layer of potential accountability or a firewall or at least some friction. In the case of face recognition systems, these are going to be built out inside police departments. So there's no way of ensuring that there's accountability about how that technology is used or in what circumstances. And for those reasons, yes, we think that the appropriate response in this particular case is to press pause, have the deliberate debate, have the legislature come up with what they think the right regulations are to protect civil rights and civil liberties and, frankly, democracy. And then enact those, and only after that allow for the technology to be used by
just,
the government.
Okay, just briefly, Hiawatha, can I just get a caller in here? Susan is calling from Cambridge. Susan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Given that this situation is sort of a, it's a balancing act. I'm wondering if anyone has any idea whether or not not using this stuff and trying to solve kidnappings, et cetera, without the aid of technology, how would that have gone? Mm-hmm. Would they have found this girl as fast as they did? And It's a trade-off.
I think that's a question.
The police department would not have found
this is Chief Nee.
They did if they did not have this technology available to them. And I'd like to just get back to Kate Crawford's point about the legislature. I think law enforcement, in good faith, the law has not kept up with the pace of technology. But unfortunately, those who are committing crimes are very in tune to the latest technology. And I think you'd be tying the hands of law enforcement if we were not allowed to use it as well, under strict policies and with people's rights and protections in place. But the law just doesn't keep up at the same pace.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder, Hiawatha.
Totally agree with that. We think it really ought to.
Right. And Hiawatha, you were making a point there about the question of should there be no use until the legislature weighs in and has some.
I think in the case of facial recognition, yeah, I think that's a very sensible point because there's no compelling reason at this point to start using that until we really have got the technology to the point where it's reliable enough to be consistently accurate. And on top of that, then we can also think about the civil liberties issues involved. But if it isn't even working properly yet, I don't think we should be using it. Mm.
What's your advice to people right now? If they're concerned about privacy and they're concerned about what to do regarding their phone and cameras, what would you say to them, Hiawatha?
Well, there's no good answer at this point to this problem. Ultimately, the best answer I've heard it would require basically a whole re-architecting of how the Internet works. There are people like Tim Berners-Lee over at the World Wide Web Consortium over in Cambridge who's trying to come up with this idea that all your personal information would be in a separate storehouse controlled by you, including potentially your location information. And if you wanted to share that with somebody else, they would have to have your permission to connect and get that information about where you're going and where you've been. But you would have ultimate control over it. The problem with the system we have now is that, yes, it's a real life-saving technology, but Google has that information or Apple has that information, and we don't know what else they're doing with it, and we have no control over that. Mm. That's the real problem, and there's right now no good answer for it.
Right.
Well, can I? Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to jump in and say the tech industry spent $64 million lobbying Congress last year to try to prevent Congress from regulating them to ensure that they can't sell our location information willy-nilly and do, you know, untold other numbers of things that would horrify people if they knew about them. This is what we need to change. We need to change the political dynamic that lawmakers are essentially privileging the profits of these corporations, including Google, Facebook, the major telecoms, the ISPs, over the personal privacy and autonomy interests and, frankly, democratic interests of the entire population of their constituents. So if you care about that, you should call your lawmakers both here in Massachusetts and your federal representatives and tell them that you want to see strong regulation of these tech companies.
Okay, well, just
one term. Let me just throw out a term. It's called data minimization, which is a lot of what's going on here. What we need is some kind of regulation that says that if you're tracking our location, you can only do it for a specific purpose, like, you know, when I need you to find me a map of someplace. You can't keep doing it when I've turned off your app. And right now they can, and they keep doing it.
And that's for the private sector, though. But what about if we're talking about law enforcement? I mean, would that apply as well?
Well, in a sense, because where would they be getting this information? The law enforcement people aren't the ones who are tracking us 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. It's the app makers. Mm-hmm. It's the smartphone makers. And then the law enforcement goes to them and says, hey, give us all the information you've got.
Right. But I'm wondering if there have to be different rules is what I'm suggesting. Do they have to be different rules for public use or law enforcement use as opposed to corporate use?
I think so, but you have to remember, and this is what I was getting at before, much of this information is not being collected by the government in the first place. It's being collected by businesses, and then the businesses turn around and give it to the government. So to regulate this, we're going to have to some extent, regulate both.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Hiawatha Bray, tech writer for the Boston Globe, thanks for being with us.
Oh, glad to be here.
Also, Chief Kelly Nee, the chief of police for Boston University, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And Kate Crockford, Director of the Technology and Liberty Technology for Liberty Program for the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. She joined us via Skype. Kate, thank you.
Thank you very much, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, the debate over supervised drug injection sites and how it's playing out in other cities besides Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Supervised drug injection sites may be closer to becoming a reality in Massachusetts. Such sites are illegal in the U.S., but they are legal in Canada. So Boston Mayor Marty Walsh visited some sites in Canada last week, and he now says he's open to the idea.
I went from a hard no on safe injection sites to am I in the right place on that?
For part of the trip, Mayor Walsh was joined by Cambridge Mayor Mark McGovern, who said he supports these sites coming to Cambridge.
If we're really going to address our substance abuse crisis, you have to fight this on multiple fronts. You can't get someone into treatment if they die on the street, right? And I think the important thing to remember is that no one has died in a safe injection site, and that is extremely important.
Other cities around the country, including San Francisco and Philadelphia, are in the process of bringing supervised injection sites to their cities. And we want to spend some time looking at how that's playing out there. Joining me is Heather Knight, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Heather, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Abraham Gutman, an opinion writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Hi, Abraham.
Hi.
So let's talk about Philadelphia, because we thought Philadelphia was going to be the first city in the country. What's happening?
Yeah, I thought so too. So last January, the city announced that it will give basically a green light to private entities to open a safe injection site. At the time, it was called a comprehensive user engagement site. The name evolved to be an overdose prevention site, which is more appropriate. And ever since, we've been waiting. We knew that the city is not going to put taxpayer money into this project. And there was a big question of who will do this. over the summer, former Philadelphia mayor and governor Ed Rendell announced that he's incorporating a non-for-profit called Safe House that will have the intent of opening an overdose prevention site. Mm-hmm. And there is some poetic narrative justice to that because when Ed Rendell was mayor in 1992 in the peak of the AIDS crisis, he signed the executive order that allowed Philadelphia to open its first syringe exchange program, Prevention Point. Mm-hmm. So here again, he stands, and he said that if this is will be deemed by law enforcement as illegal, he said, arrest me first. So, again, echoing his sentiment from the 90s.
Right.
And since then, they've incorporated. They have hired recently Dr. Jen Bowles, a very esteemed harm reduction scholar who came back to Philadelphia after a time in California as their executive director. And now we're waiting to see where and how they get the funding and where will be the location.
Okay. And Heather, in San Francisco, what happened there?
Right around the same time, a year ago, January of 2018, our director of public health announced that San Francisco would actually become the first city in the country to open a safe injection site. I guess there was a bit of a race between San Francisco and Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
But neither one has done it yet. So it was all planned for the summer of 2018, but the problem came when a state senator from San Francisco introduced legislation at the California state level to allow San Francisco to create a pilot program for 4 years with a safe injection site and not face any blowback from the state government. And the legislature here did approve that, but Governor Jerry Brown vetoed it. And it's kind of been stalled ever since. He vetoed it in October, and there's not really been any progress since then. But we do have a new governor, Gavin Newsom, so it looks like the same state senator will try again and is more hopeful that Gavin Newsom would sign off, but he wouldn't do that until the fall of this year, so it's still quite a ways out.
So it's still a race between the two of you, between the two cities we were on the line with.
Very slow race.
Well, I just want to play a bit of tape from Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, because he spoke with WBUR after he visited these sites in Canada last week, and he said there are some issues that he's still thinking about in terms of what he thinks needs to be addressed before he could endorse the sites. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
You need a consistent funding mechanism. We'd have to get a buy-in from the federal government, but also the state and local governments. And then we would have to build out these facilities. Even if the legislature approved this tomorrow, we cannot do it.
So I don't think Boston's necessarily going to be in this race. But I wonder, let's talk about funding. Because, Abraham, you had said initially no tax money going toward the facility in Philadelphia, and funding sounds like it might be an issue there, or has Philadelphia figured out how such a site might be funded?
So Safe House is looking for donation fundraising their way to a site, which is a shame in a sense, because there should be taxpayer money going to this. One thing that is often glanced on when we talk about overdose prevention sites is that they save a lot of money. Opioid addiction and other drug addictions are not necessarily a very expensive issue if they are not neglected. So, for example, unsafe injection, which is the alternative to safe injection, using non-sterile and clean water, using reusing syringes, causes abscesses, wounds, heart infections, you know, can transmit diseases such as HIV and hepatitis C, which all incur really high healthcare costs on the taxpayer. And by every analysis, one that's been done in San Francisco and one that's also been done on Philadelphia specifically, shows that safe injection sites, overdose prevention sites, depending on how they're called, save a lot of money and are cost efficient. So there's even an efficiency imperative to them.
Okay, so it would basically be donations. And Heather, what about San Francisco?
The city kind of wanted to keep its hands off of it. It wanted to approve, give it the go-ahead, but not be the one to actually run it. So our plan would have a nonprofit, possibly Glide Memorial Church or another nonprofit actually be the site of a safe injection site. It would probably be located in our Tenderloin neighborhood, which is where most homeless and injection drug users already are, and most services for them. And it would probably be in a site that's already working with that population, so as not to irritate neighbors who wouldn't want a new service in their neighborhood, since it would be in one that's already kind of offering a similar thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, the big issue, of course, is illegal drugs. And we actually, our U.S. attorney in Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling, has come out quite strong about these sites and reminding folks that they are absolutely illegal, and he will prosecute them to, I think they call it, the fullest extent of the law. We interviewed him about this a while ago. He said these are a terrible idea. Here's a little clip of that interview.
The issue with supervised injection sites is that there are federal laws that prohibit distributing controlled substances, facilitating distribution of controlled substances, or maintaining a premises where controlled substances are stored or distributed or things like that. And supervised injection sites would fall under those laws. They would also fall under civil and criminal forfeiture laws that would allow the federal government to seize a premises in which that kind of activity was going on.
So really, those are two prongs, but we've also heard of a third since that interview with Lelling. So I can go after you because the drugs are illegal, says U.S. Attorney Lelling. I can also go into civil forfeiture laws and take the property if there are any, because it's being maintained because of drug proceeds. And also, he has since said that medical folks could be held liable for what's happening here. So with all of those things, were you hearing similar things from law enforcement in your communities, Abraham?
Yeah, so Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein told the AWHY, the NPR affiliate here in Philadelphia, a similar statement after his New York Times op-ed where he said that he will crack down on it. Our U.S. attorney, again, the statements are almost identical. I would like to push back on the notion that that overdose prevention sites are illegal. There's no law that says that they're illegal. There is a law that is known as the crack house statute that is intended to prevent, again, houses that sell crack, as in the clip that you played, distribution of drugs, sale of drugs, storage of drugs. This is not what overdose prevention sites do. So there is a very strong case that the law was never intended to also encompass a public health intervention. And again, it's worth looking back when during the AIDS crisis in the early 1990s, syringe exchange programs were illegal in a much more explicit way, by the way. There were laws in every state that says that the distribution or possession of syringes without prescription is illegal. And yet activists decided that while people are dying, we can't wait for the law. And open sites, open syringe exchanges, some U.S. attorneys, some attorney generals tried to prosecute them and failed largely. Either judges dismissed the cases, juries found it that there's a necessity defense, meaning that they broke the law, but it was for a good reason, which is public health. And other cities like Philadelphia decided by local ordinance to give authority and give the backing of the city. So my response is bring it. There is really a good case legally. It could be challenged. There is no reason to go through that process. And also on civil forfeitures, there's no proceeds from drugs in the overdose prevention sites. So I don't see the legality as something that is as clear as a bunch of law enforcement officials contend that it is.
But Philadelphia is certainly aware that this can be a major legal fight. There's a major law firm, right, that the nonprofit, I think, has retained just in case.
Yeah, it might be challenged. And I could argue that, you know, maybe, hopefully, if I'm trying to, you know, be optimistic for a second, maybe it's a good thing if an overdose prevention site is challenged, but meanwhile is allowed to operate, so we can have a ruling by a federal court that gives an exemption for public health interventions from the crack house statute.
Mm-hmm. Just briefly, I just want to get to Heather. Heather, legally in San Francisco, what are you hearing from law enforcement officials there?
Well, this being San Francisco, nobody here is saying they would do anything about it. The police and district attorney are pretty hands-off, and the only worry is coming as what the federal government would do after Rod Rosenstein's statements in the New York Times and elsewhere that that a church or a nonprofit or whoever actually housed it would be at risk, and even the people who work for the nonprofit would be at risk of arrest. That's what they're worried about. Of course, also San Francisco already has a big target on its back with the Trump administration for a whole host of reasons, including the sanctuary city issues, Nancy Pelosi being the Speaker of the House, and I don't think there's a huge drive to challenge them even more on this immediately unless we can get state backing, which we haven't done yet.
So it sounds like we're still a ways away, but if you had to wager, which one of you would win the race here? Heather.
I think we're going to get the governor's sign off this fall, and then it'll happen pretty quickly because the plan's pretty much in place. So I would say maybe within a year we'll actually do it, but you never know.
Within a year? How about you, Abraham?
I definitely hope that 2019 is the year that we have a running overdose prevention site. And I will say multiple sites, because that's really what we need. And yeah, I hope that both cities will have one or a few like yesterday.
All right. Well, we'll see. I think that means you're saying you think Philadelphia is going to win. Abraham Gutman, an opinion writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Heather Knight, columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, how to measure fake news on Twitter. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Nearly $2 billion. That's what Massachusetts spent last year on drugs prescribed to patients covered by MassHealth. The total was half that just 6 years ago. And Governor Charlie Baker's budget for the coming year includes a proposal to curb the trend and save $80 million. WBUR's Martha Biebinger brings us this report.
In short, Governor Baker wants the authority to negotiate lower drug prices. If that doesn't work, the state could set a price. If drug makers refuse, a state commission could hold hearings, and state prosecutors could claim a violation of consumer protection laws. The plan may sound sweeping, but Baker describes a narrow target.
It affects a very small number of drugs. They happen to be a very small number of drugs that have very, very, very big prices on them.
Baker mentions about 20 relatively new drugs. Two that cure hepatitis C retail for $84,000 and $94,000 each. Federal law requires that pharmaceutical companies give Medicaid a 23% rebate. But Baker says that's not enough.
There really isn't a process for determining what an appropriate price is for a lot of those new drugs, which is what these 20 drugs fall into. Yet there is a process for determining the price of almost everything else that Medicaid pays for.
MassBio, with more than 1,000 life science members in the state, issued a statement challenging Baker's proposal just a few minutes after the governor finished speaking. No one was available for an interview, but Vice President Zach Stanley reads a portion of that statement here.
Governor Baker's proposal to force certain drug manufacturers to pay supplemental rebates on incredibly effective drugs that MassHealth deems too expensive sends a message across the life sciences industry that government is going to punish success and that only it can be the final arbiter of drug pricing.
Baker was asked if he worries that challenging drug prices will lead to job cuts. He defended the state's record of support for the industry.
Massachusetts, for many years, has made a big investment in the life sciences. It's really important. The discovery really matters.
Consumer advocates agree, but say some of those important discoveries are just not affordable for patients, their employers, and state government. Amy Rosenthal with Healthcare for All says Massachusetts has a long-standing tradition in healthcare of shared responsibility.
Consumers have stepped up, businesses have stepped up, hospitals and insurers. It's time that pharma does their fair share, and we think that this is the year to do that.
New York passed a law that's similar to Baker's proposal. It's early to say if such state laws will reduce drug prices.
It certainly tilts the playing field more in favor of the state than exists right now.
Tom Barker was general counsel for Health and Human Services under President George W. Bush. Baker's plan would not need federal approval, but Barker says the governor may face other obstacles.
There certainly are political risks if the manufacturer just decides they're not going to sell their drug in Massachusetts.
That risk is a ways off. First, Baker must persuade the House and Senate that his drug price negotiation plan is wise. A spokeswoman for Senate President Karen Spilka says the Senate will likely file something similar to help move this issue forward.
That report from WBUR's Martha Biebinger. It's a term we've been hearing a lot about lately, fake news.
I think the biggest piece of fake news in this election was that Donald Trump couldn't win.
It's called fake news.
And we know that the Russians were promulgating fake news through Facebook and other outlets.
You are fake news.
A new study claims that fake news Twitter engagement during the 2016 presidential election was highly concentrated among a small group of users who tended to be politically engaged, older, and more conservative. One of the study's authors is David Lazar, a professor and computational social scientist at Northeastern University, and he joins us on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So this idea that Twitter is kind of, the land of where fake news and falsehoods can grow is not exactly new. So what did your study find?
So we tried to look at how much actual humans were exposed to fake news on Twitter during the election and how much they were sharing. And what we found was actually the amount of fake news on Twitter was modest. It wasn't nothing. It wasn't massive. It was around 5% of what people were exposed to. But most of that exposure was concentrated in about 1 in 100 people. 99% of people didn't see very much fake news. And then on the sharing side, we found this really remarkable concentration of sharing, so that around 80% of fake news came from 0.1% of accounts, and so that was a result that surprised us. We expected it to be concentrated, but not that concentrated.
Right. So, what do you take from that?
Well, in some sense, fake news is a problem, but it's not. It's more of a problem of a small, seedy corner of Twitter, right? At least within Twitter, and of course, we can talk about other platforms and other places on the internet, which may be a different story. But on Twitter, it's not so much of a systemic problem in the U.S. right now, or at least as of 2 years ago, and that's rather different from the popular picture that has been painted of what's going on the medium.
We got a couple of questions that this study raises. First off, how do you classify fake news?
A great question. There are lots of ways you could classify it, and I wouldn't be classifying it in the same way as in the clips that you were playing. The way we define fake news is at the publisher level, or at the whoever is putting that content out there and vouching for it. And the notion is that truth is produced by institutions, and some of them have the intent to produce accurate information and sometimes make mistakes. So like WBUR it has the intent to put out accurate information, and no doubt every once in a while a mistake is made, but that's because it's institutions are have humans running them. And but clearly some publishers do not have that particular intent about getting accurate information. And so we define fake news as really being at the publisher level, as not having the intent to put accurate information out there. Mm-hmm. And the way we did it in the study was we looked at sites that were repeatedly shot down for egregious errors by fact checkers, and then didn't make any corrections. Mm. And so we classified a few hundred sites as being quote unquote fake news sites based on that definition.
Mm. I just want to mention this controversy this week about the confrontation in Washington between the Kentucky high school students and a Native American elder. I mean, really, this started on Twitter. A Twitter account shared a 1-minute video of this confrontation, and then that led to this whole national brouhaha. And that Twitter account has since been suspended. I mean, what do you take from your study in an incident like that on Twitter?
Well, I think part of the big picture here is Twitter is a whole menagerie of creatures. And in this particular case, and we've actually been digging into what was going on with this one account, it, like many of the fake news sharers in our study, was super sharing, meaning it was sharing 100, 200 news-related stories every day. And I think that part of the strategy here, the misinformation side, is to just pump lots of content into the social media in the hope that it will get picked up on. Interestingly, in the case of this one account, its audience was much more tilted towards the left and had much more engagement amongst Democrats than Republicans. And actually had a lot of engagement. We were surprised when we were looking at the numbers how much engagement this one account had among people in our sample. And so so that's an interesting counterexample in another way from what we found in the study published today.
Hmm. All right. Well, I wish we had more time to talk, but we have to go. David Lazar, professor and computational social scientist at Northeastern. He is one of the authors of a new study out today in Science, and there's a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.